Suppose your belief in something is so strong that you exercise every power you can to make it real. The kingdom of God, for instance. And then suppose you got elected to public office. Where would you run afoul of the First Amendment? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. An evangelical Christian from Alaska might be a heartbeat away from the presidency. Are you okay with that? The phone lines are open at 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call, 550-8422. Is Joel's Army rejoicing? On the Ramadan edition of Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Well, hopefully this program is an appeal to reason. It was more than 20 years ago when I invited myself to a meeting at a home in Anchorage of Christian ladies who were campaigning for Republican State Senate candidate Jan Fakes. She became the president of the Senate later on. She was known for her, quote, "rich people need representation too." This group was called Concerned Women for America. It had never had any publicity. I just happened to see the notice in the social notes of the newspaper right next to the bridge clubs. And I was curious what these women were concerned about. They were very welcoming, even flattered that their good works were getting some media attention. They brought their babies and their knitting, and they talked about organizing their neighborhoods for their candidate. They opened the meeting with a prayer, and it became clear to me as the meeting went on that it was all about righteousness and family values and so forth. One of them told me in an interview that, quote, "we believe in putting feet to our prayers." Now, where does the First Amendment come in a situation like this? When your belief gets to the point where you want to go through the machinery of state to accomplish your vision. There used to be a time when there were established religions. There were state religions. There were branches of Christianity that ran entire states, like Massachusetts, for instance. And that's one of the reasons we have a First Amendment. Well, here to straighten out and help us talk amongst ourselves here about this prospect of where religious views and the Constitution and the machinery of state intersect is David Mashey, Senior Research Fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life in Washington, D.C. He joins us by telephone. David, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Steve. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, good. I asked you to study this situation of Elder Leland before we, as we were preparing for the show, because I think it says something about what the First Amendment was put in there for. And so, you know, knowing that you have and knowing that you do look at this church-state issue a lot, do you think people have a little bit of a misunderstanding of what sort of a barrier the First Amendment puts between the affairs of state and the affairs of faith?
Well, I think that most people don't probably. I think on one level people have some sense of it, and I think on other levels they probably don't have a very clear sense. And part of the reason isn't their fault. Our courts have changed their view of the First Amendment over time, and sometimes their decisions are quite confusing. Sometimes they zigzag between one principle and another, so it can be confusing even for people who try to follow this pretty closely. And say for a person, let's say your average person who may occasionally think about this, not spend a whole lot of time on it. Yes, I think that it can be very easily confusing. I think most Americans probably have some sense that the Constitution protects their right worship, that there is freedom of worship in this country, and that's certainly true. They probably also have heard terms like separation of church and state, and they probably think that what that means is that the government doesn't really involve itself so deeply in religious affairs, certainly doesn't favor one religious denomination or group over another, and that also is largely true. So I think they have a general sense that is probably pretty close to correct. On the details, my guess is a lot of people are probably a little confused. And again, I think just because it's not all that easy to fully figure out exactly where the First Amendment stands right now.
Yeah, and of course, as Supreme Court justices change, all this is going to change, and the kind of doctrine that they go by is also going to change this.
Right. I mean, I think just to give you an example, until the 1940s, the First Amendment's religion clauses, the clause dealing with the free exercise of religion or religious liberty, and the clause dealing with establishment of religion, or again, what some people might incorrectly call the separation of church and state, those did not apply to the states. They only applied to the federal government. And my guess is a lot of people probably don't know that. The Supreme Court applied them in the 1940s in a couple of decisions to the states as well. So I think that's just one example, for example, of where there might be some confusion. And as you mentioned a little earlier, there were established state churches in this country until the 1830s. Which also might surprise some people.
Well, if we go back to the 1780s, when Elder Leland was a Baptist minister in Virginia, we find him talking to James Madison and already advocating for this. He plays a role in getting Madison named to the ratification convention, and then he goes to Massachusetts, and he is located in a parish in the Berkshires, which is the only Baptist parish in the entire state of Massachusetts, which does have an established religion of Congregationalism, and he's a Baptist. And he has this vision that we need something in this nation that allows probably us Baptists, he's thinking, to not be oppressed by this Congregationalist religion.
Yeah, I think it's a very illustrative and common sort of example. And I say common in a good sense. I think that, you know, a lot of people probably think that religious diversity in America is a relatively new thing. It actually has been with us since long before the founding of the Republic. There were in the 1740s, in the 1750s, there was something called a Great Awakening, where we saw a great outpouring of religious fervor. But one of the outgrowths of the Great Awakening was a much greater religious diversity in America. Now, most of these people were still Christian. America was at the time and still remains a country largely populated by Christians of one sort or another. But, you know, we saw a new sort of sects becoming much more prominent: Baptists, Methodists. We'd always had Quakers in this country, but in many parts of the country, there was a lot of religious diversity. Virginia is a very, very good example, which, of course, is where James Madison was from. Even in central Virginia, where he ran for Congress, he saw all of these different sects. And he saw, by the way, some of them, I believe, Baptists, if I'm remembering correctly, like Pastor Leland's sect, Baptists were persecuted. Now, I also want to be careful. This was not, when I say persecuted, they were not killed, but they were discriminated against. And there was at the time, of course, in Virginia, an established church. It was the Anglican Church first, and then the American Episcopal Church following the Revolution. I think this had certainly a pretty strong impact on Madison and on his thinking about religious liberty. Certainly, I mean, there is not one author of the Constitution, and there is not one author of the First Amendment, even. But if there is an indispensable man in both of these endeavors, I think it would have to be James Madison. And certainly, he was the one who first proposed language concerning religious liberty and concerning also the establishment of religion in America. Baptists and other Christian denominations, particularly, but also non-Christian denominations. Jews have been in America since almost the very beginning of European settlement, certainly, I think they were also in people's minds as our founders tried to sort of grapple with this issue and try to figure out exactly how the relationship between state and religion should be sussed out.
All right, thank you very much. That was nicely done. David Mashey is senior research fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and I've given him a tough duty for an hour today to deal with your questions and concerns about are we at risk of theocracy? What does the First Amendment actually bar? And things like that. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org, and that tends to come in handy a little bit later on in the show. So, David, I'd like to fast forward now to the full moon that we just had yesterday. And when this month began, this lunar month began, it was also the beginning of Ramadan. And Ramadan is a time of Islamic observance, somewhat similar to Lent, in that a person is asked to make themselves open. It's thought to be the time when Muhammad received the inspiration of the Quran. And so maybe there's at this particular month some particular receptivity or something like that to the will of Allah. And so believers then are they're the rules essentially in both Shia and Sunni are very similar, and they have to do with a kind of a restraint in action. You can see some of this echoed in the Jewish faith as well, a restraint in action, a refraining from eating during the daylight hours, which is, you know, difficult in Alaska, but, you know, we're getting to about the same day length as everybody else by this time of year. And generally a restraint in behavior and a reflectivity in hopes that you're open to this inspiration to be touched.
Right.
Well, we have also a Christian sect, a very large and growing Christian sect known as the various different ones that are called charismatic, but they also believe in being directly touched, Pentecostalism. It's denigrated as being holy rollers. It's the idea that the Holy Spirit comes into a person. Maybe you speak in tongues, maybe you dance, maybe there's healing.
Right.
And in fact, many people in Pentecostal religions believe that they regularly receive miracles from God, that
right.
they are touched.
Right.
They pray, and they are touched by God. They believe that. Now, what I'm trying to bring out, I guess, is that that this is in the area of a person's beliefs, but it's getting really, really close to their actions at this point. And we've seen down through the years when people's beliefs become so strong that it drives them to try and make history happen. Maybe everyone wants to make history happen. And so we see things like people who are willing to really become very strong in their actions at, say, abortion clinics because it's a belief thing for them.
Right.
The thing is, where does it hit the First Amendment? If we elect someone to public office and they have a belief in bringing forth the kingdom of God on Earth, where would somebody say, wait a minute, that's not what our Constitution says. We have a First Amendment here.
Right.
I don't think there's a hard and fast line. It's not at having a litmus test for Supreme Court justices, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be careful here. Certainly, if someone says, I am pro-life or I'm pro-choice, for example, on the question of abortion, and that my views on abortion or my views on same-sex marriage, my views on the death penalty, whatever the issue is, are informed by my faith, okay? Politicians say that all the time, and it's perfectly fine. They have a freedom, the same freedom of conscience and freedom of belief that every other American citizen enjoys. When they get out on the hustings and they start talking about what they believe and what they don't believe, they're giving voters a chance to either accept or reject those views. When election day comes. So when people say, when George Bush or Bill Clinton, for that matter, talks about their faith or brings up the Bible or something like that, that violates the Constitution's Establishment Clause. That's just not true. It does not. Not that this in any way is determinative, but most Americans are comfortable with their politicians speaking about their faith. And as a matter of fact, Pew has a poll out just recently that showed that 72% of the American public wants the president to be a person of faith. They want the president to have strong religious beliefs. So not only is it constitutional, but at least as far as public opinion is concerned, a very solid majority of people are fine with that. Now, if you talk about somebody who says something to the effect of, now that I've been elected president or now that I'm in public office, I'm going to use this public office to further a particular religious doctrine, and in doing so I'm going to coerce other people, let's say, or I'm going to start forcing government institutions to toe a certain, the line in certain areas based on my religious, the doctrines of my church, then you violated the Constitution. Because even though there is certainly a lot of disagreement in our country over exactly what the founders meant when they said that the federal government shall not establish a church, okay, or establish a religion, everyone pretty much agrees that that means, A, there shall be no state church, there shall be no Church of England-like sort of church in America, and secondly, that the government can't really discriminate against various religious groups. In other words, the government can't favor Protestants over Catholics, even though there have been cases in the deep past when that happened. That the government has to basically play fair with religious groups. And in reality, it's not really supposed to favor religion over non-religion, although what exactly that means, the courts have kind of gone back and forth on, and we can talk a little bit about that if you like. But I guess my central point is there is a line between saying, on these various public policy issues, my faith is an important source of my views on them, and a line that says I want to impose the teachings of my church, specifically on the country. I want my church, in a sense, to become the state church by virtue of the fact that I've been elected and I'm now, enacting laws and programs that do that. So there is a line, at least in that sense. Now, there are some fuzzy areas, obviously, and again, we can try to talk a little bit about that too. But there hasn't been, I know of no president, for example, who's decided that a particular church was going to be the state church and has tried to impose those beliefs on his fellow citizens. So that danger has not, at least at this up to this point, has not arisen.
Now, you said the Pew Forum's excellent survey work has shown that 72% of American people want a believing person in public office who lives out the values of their religion, I believe.
Right.
And I'm thinking if there had been a Pew Forum around in the 1790s, they would have probably got a higher number, although they wouldn't have counted slaves or women.
They might have. I'm not sure about that.
But, we won't speak for the Pew people.
Right. Look, this is a religious country. I mean, people need to understand that. Most Americans, almost all Americans, say that they believe in God. And, you know, substantial portion of the American public attends some sort of house of worship regularly. 40% of America, all Americans, go to church at least once a week, to give you a sense of that. And when you include people who say go once or twice a month, it's well over 50%. It's close to 60%. So, this is a religious country. It is much more religious than other countries that are similar, at least socioeconomically, to the United States. And by that I mean Western European countries, Japan, countries that are wealthy democracies, let's say. Most of those countries have much lower levels of religious commitment than the United States, lower levels of belief in God, lower levels of people who say they pray, lower levels of people who go to church, much lower, actually. And in some cases, like a country like France, dramatically lower.
Supposed to be a Catholic nation.
Yeah. Well, it is a very secular country, at least as far as we can tell now. We have to be very careful when we use polling data. We're only giving people part of the view of reality. Polls can't tell you everything about how people really feel, but they can give us some sense of things, and then that's what I think I'm trying to offer up now. I think that the United States, people need to understand the United States is a religious country, and not surprisingly, the American people want the president to be, at least to some degree, like themselves. Now, they're also... That doesn't mean that most people want the president to have their religion or their Christian denomination, let's say.
That's a good point, yeah.
There doesn't seem to be too much problem. In spite of our past history, when, of course, it was very hard to imagine, at least at one point in our history, a Roman Catholic being elected president, today that's not really a big issue at all. Of course, we've already elected one Roman Catholic, and in the last election, another Roman Catholic almost won the presidency, John Kerry. So I think Catholic, Protestant, that's not a big issue anymore. In fact, it really isn't an issue at all. Polling was also done during the 2000 election when Joe Lieberman was running as Al Gore's vice presidential running mate. Now, of course, Joe Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, is an Orthodox Jew. By very, very, very overwhelming margins, the American people said that's not a problem for them. So the idea, I think, at this point of electing a Jewish president is probably not really a big deal, as it, say, might have been 50 or 100 years ago. When we come to a Muslim president, there we have more potential for conflict, because a substantial minority of the American public say that they have some suspicions of Islam. That still might be a problem. In other words, if a Muslim man or woman ran for the highest office in the land, their religion might certainly play a role in the election. And of course, we saw recently with Mitt Romney and his candidacy, there is still some concern among some people about a Mormon candidate. Even though many of the sort of issues of the past, Roman Catholicism, Judaism, they're not really big issues anymore in the political arena, there still are some religious traditions, Mormonism and Islam being the two examples that I think we can come up with right now, where the tradition, their religious tradition, is a big issue still. It's very interesting. Mitt Romney, if you recall, during their campaign, made a speech, where he tried to sort of reassure people that he was not going to be the Mormon president, that he was going to be the president of the United States and the president of all Americans, of all people of all faiths. Very, very similar to the sort of speech that President Kennedy made before he was elected, a very famous speech he made in Houston to a group of ministers in 1960, where he said very much the same thing. I believe, you know, very much in what he said was the separation of church and state. And he also said, I'm not going to be a Catholic president. You know, I'm not going to call the Vatican every time I have an issue that I need to decide. And that was a fear that a lot of Americans had at the time. That he would have divided loyalties. And so he had to try to reassure people that was not going to be the case. I think to some degree, Mitt Romney had to make the same sort of reassurance. Of course, he didn't get as far along in his candidacy as President Kennedy did. But still, I mean, I think it was quite significant that he felt the need to come out and talk about his faith and reassure people that his Mormon faith was not going to mean that he was going to impose, anything on the American people as a result of being raised in that tradition.
David Mosche, you're just a gold mine.
Oh, well.
Our guest is David Mosche, Senior Research Fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. And I think we'll open it up for the calls now. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. And Peggy has been waiting patiently. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Peggy.
Hi, thank you for taking a historical perspective on this issue, because I'm old enough to actually remember that 1960 campaign between Kennedy and Nixon.
Me too.
During that campaign, there were the John Birchers and the Southern Baptists both stoked widespread fear that a Catholic president would carry out the will of the Vatican, and that Catholic would erode the First Amendment separation of church and state. And the ACLU, among others, decried such questioning as fear-mongering in the guise of asking real questions. And I'm wondering, do you two think that people who ask if there's a risk of theocracy or a danger to the First Amendment because Sarah Palin is an active church member, do you see any similarity between what went on in the 1960s campaign with the attack against Kennedy and what's going on today with Sarah Palin?
I think there's two branches to that, and I think both are happening. On the one hand, we're just in the last few days, newspapers have passed out a CD of a movie entitled Obsession, which is all about how there's an Islamic holy war against the United States. The odd thing is that this distribution is only in election swing states that the Republicans are trying to gain. So having said that, then we turn back to the to people nervous about Sarah Palin. There's definitely an issue there, I think, wouldn't you say?
In both of them, perhaps. Both of them are fear-mongering, you're saying, the attacks on Palin and then the submission of apparently another fear-mongering thing as a thing against Muslims.
Thing against Muslims, but it goes along with this sort of whispering campaign that Obama isn't really Christian enough, that he's got some kind of Muslim root that we need to worry about.
So fear-mongering against Obama and against Palin.
That's
their religions.
That is my perception. I don't know. Let's see how David Mosche sees it. And he's not here to be political. He's just, you know, this will be a personal opinion if he chooses to give one. David?
Well, I can't even give a personal opinion. What I can say is that certainly, some people have tried to keep this idea of Obama being a Muslim alive, and he's been categorical in his statement over and over again that he is a Christian, I think that sort of the fact that he feels the need to say that speaks to what I was saying a little earlier, which is that, you know, for some people, the idea that, you know, we might have a president who is a Muslim is still very troublesome. I mean, the polls.
You think it's troublesome for people, the thought of having an evangelical as a vice president?
Well, I mean, we probably have an evangelical president right now. I only say probably because I'm not 100% sure exactly where George Bush is theologically, but it seems
hasn't had any effect on the separation of powers. George Bush hasn't had any effect on the separation of powers.
Are you kidding?
Let me finish also. And we've also had, Jimmy Carter was an evangelical Christian. Bill Clinton, at least to some degree, I mean, he was a Southern Baptist, and Southern Baptists, you know, that's an evangelical denomination.
To the question, when we have people saying, do we have to fear a risk of theocracy with Sarah Palin, was that question asked with Jimmy Carter?
I don't know. I mean, I know that his religion was an issue, and I know that, of course, Bush's, to some degree, especially in the 2004 campaign, was an issue. Certainly, I'm not here to say that there was never any risk of such thing. All I can say is that I haven't seen any evidence from Carter or Bush that was the case. I mean, look, these people understand that we live in a very, very pluralistic and a very diverse society. Now, as I said a little earlier, the United States is, most Americans still consider themselves to be Christian. About 8 in 10 still say that they're Christians. First of all, even within Christianity, there's tremendous diversity. Diversity. We have thousands of different groups and denominations and things like that. And then we have, a large number of people who say we're born in a Christian household, but don't consider themselves to be religious at all. They'll say that they're quote unquote spiritual, but not religious. We call those people unaffiliated. We have some people who just reject religion altogether. It's not really that large a group, but about 4% of Americans say that they're either agnostic or atheist. And then we have, religious minorities. 1.7%, I believe, of American adults are Jewish. About 1.7% of American adults are Mormons. Now, Mormons consider themselves to be Christians. Some Christians say that they're not. We have about 2 million or so Buddhists in this country. We have about 1 million Hindus. We have a couple of million Muslims. We've got a lot of, these are small groups. Some of them are growing quite rapidly, though, like the Muslim population in this country. So we've got certainly a very diverse country. And I don't think anyone who is elected president or wants to be president is going to, at least it's not, it, at least if we look back in history, people have not certainly tried to play up a kind of some sort of religious exclusivity, and certainly no one has talked about theocracy or anything like that.
I heard a risk of theocracy was the exact term, because I wrote it down, that was posed as a possible threat by Palin on this show. That was shifted within the half hour.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. Obviously, some people feel that way.
That's Peggy. I wrote that, and I'm hearing people who are made nervous by the Palin candidacy, by her popularity, and worry that she, even though there has been no sign in her official acts that we've been able to find, that she would seek to impose religious views on people.
But I guess that's my point. How is your asking this question any different from people who ask, is Obama a secret Republican, or would John F. Kennedy take orders from the Vatican? Sometimes just asking these questions when there is no objective conduct of the person to justify them is fear-mongering. It's sort of like asking, have you stopped beating your wife yet?
I gotcha. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
By the way, I assume you meant a secret Muslim, not a secret Republican, with regard to Obama.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right, Peggy. Thanks for your call. 1-800-478-8825. That ought to get us started as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-2555, 1-800-478-TALK. Yeah, David Mashey of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life is with us.
I was just going to say, during the break, I pulled up the Pew Forum website, which, by the way, is, I think, a terrific resource. It's at pewforum.org if people are interested. We have a lot of information about Sarah Palin, and that's what I pulled up, actually, because I knew that we had written something about her views on church and state, and if I could just read the sentence that we've written about it, it might help people a little bit.
Great.
In response to a question about religious leaders endorsing political candidates, Palin said, quote, "Faith is very important to so many of us here in America, and I would never support any government effort to stifle our freedom of religion or freedom of expression or freedom of speech." End quote. And then she said, during the 2006 campaign for Alaska governor, Palin said her interpretation of the Bible would, quote, would not, quote, bleed over into policy. So, end quote. So, at least by her own words, she seems to be saying, you don't have to worry about my religious views in any way coercing people or taking people's freedoms away from them. But anyway, those are her words, not ours. But they're just up on our website. So if people are interested in learning more about her views on a variety of issues, we also have published a religious biography of her, which is short but very, very interesting, I think. They're all available, again, on the Pew Forum website at www.pewforum.org. So.
Okay, yeah. I couldn't really run down in my introduction where the word theocracy appeared, and that's because it didn't.
Okay.
But I think it did come up in the conversation. I think it was sort of along the lines of, is the First Amendment capable of stopping a drift toward theocracy? In other words, if there were people of a certain belief that kept getting elected over and over again and named to the Supreme Court, certainly over time the values of those people would be reflected in government. The First Amendment couldn't stop that.
Well, I mean, obviously, if you have 9 members of the Supreme Court, or even 5, who decide that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause doesn't keep the government from establishing a religion, I mean, they would be going against, you know, literally decades and decades of precedent. It's sort of hard to imagine. And certainly the current Supreme Court doesn't seem to be headed down that road, at least as far as I can tell. But, That being said, how we view the First Amendment, how the court views the First Amendment, has changed. In some cases, it's changed pretty dramatically.
Right. That's exactly why I wanted to start out with Elder Leland and that whole deal. You know, I got to tell a story here just before we get to William's call here from Fairbanks. When the turn of the century comes, there is a very, very contentious presidential campaign, which Thomas Jefferson ends up winning. And Jefferson is accused of being an atheist because he is what is called a deist at the time. He doesn't particularly like religious sects. He wants his God pure, I guess you could say. But whatever, people interpreted that as being a different form of atheism and that he would make atheism the state religion. And when he was elected, for his inauguration, a giant cheese arrived that was made from cows on a certain day. All the cows in Elder Leland's pasturage up there in Cheshire, Massachusetts, they took the milk of one day and they made an enormous cheese out of it. And the Elder Leland hauled it on down to Washington for the inauguration, preaching, of course, along the way as people saw this enormous cheese getting stinkier and stinkier as it traveled. And that is the origin of the expression, the big cheese.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, right, the big cheese. Love that. William in Fairbanks, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning. My question, I guess, I would like your guest to address kind of the murky intersection between religion and race or ethnicity with regard to here in Alaska, the Native peoples are allowed to violate game laws in order to kill moose for potluck ceremonies or events. And also with regard to peyote, which is a sacrament of the, I guess it's called the Native American religion, several other practices.
Right.
And in both instances, they run afoul of the laws of both the federal government and the state government, I guess, with regard to potluck killing of moose out of season. Could you comment on these circumstances and events. I'm a little uncertain as to what the status of peyote as a religious sacrament is.
It's constitutionally protected. We've been through that thoroughly.
Well, actually, I mean,
is it constitutionally protected for people of all ethnicities? Anyway, I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Okay, well,
yeah,
thank you.
I'm not familiar with the particular situation in Alaska, so I have to be a little careful about what I say. What I can talk about is sort of general principles. Look, the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause guarantees, the free exercise of religion. And the Supreme Court has interpreted that over the course of, more than 140 years, has interpreted that to mean, look, when it comes to religious belief, in other words, what you believe to be true, the government absolutely has no place in any way to, in regulating that. So you have complete freedom of belief. Now, when it comes to religious practices like smoking peyote, let's say, or, sacrificing animals.
Yeah, by the way, you usually ingest peyote.
Ingest, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Shows you what I know.
Yeah.
When it comes to religious practices that run up against laws, so let's say there is a law that says, you can't take various narcotics, and peyote is say, one of them. Then we get into a situation that is much more murky, and it depends on the court, until recently, has had a pretty strict view that the laws of the state are going to probably trump your religious rights when they're in conflict. Now, in the 1970s, that changed, and the court sort of set out a new standard, which basically said that, if the government has a very, very strong interest in enforcing this law, what they call the compelling interest, then the law will stand. But otherwise, the religious practice will stand. Now, the court in the last 10 or 15 years has reversed itself again, and it's basically said, no, the government in most cases doesn't really need this compelling interest. They just need to have what they call a legitimate interest. In other words, as long as there's some sort of good reason for the law, in this case, regulating illegal narcotics, you might say, well, they don't want people to walk around they don't want people to endanger themselves, let's say. And as long as the law doesn't discriminate against religion, in other words, as long as the law wasn't passed with religious people just in mind, then the law is fine. In other words, then the law trumps the religious practice. Now, I know that's confusing because the court's kind of zigzagged around on this, but that's where things are right now. After that decision, which I think came in 1990 or 1991, The government actually stepped in, the Congress, I should say, stepped in and passed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And what that bill did was it sort of took the court's old standard, the compelling interest standard, the one I talked about just a few seconds ago, and made it law. Well, the court sort of struck most of that law down. They said Congress could regulate federal law, but not state law. So, in other words, it applies to federal government laws that run up against religious practices, but not state government laws. And the government not to get too confusing or too complicated here, but the government then passed another law called RLUIPA, and I'm not even going to go into that too deeply, but that focuses on just two areas where religious people and religious organizations kind of commonly run up against government regulations. One of them is religion in institutions like prisons and mental hospitals, where people are confined, because prisoners often find themselves being denied their religious rights. And the other area is land use. Okay, this is a very big area in American in American law and religion. Churches that want to expand, let's say, build a new church someplace, let's say downtown, they often run into local governments that don't want them there. Why? Because they don't pay property taxes, and they're not as valuable, let's say, as a a source of revenue for a local government. Or let's say they want to put a church in a suburban area, and all the people who live in that area say, we don't want them here because on Sunday there are going to be traffic jams, and we don't want that. So this new law, which, by the way, has so far been upheld by the Supreme Court, just focuses on land use and prisoners. But getting back to the peyote issue, you know, the court did address that, and they actually, these two Native Americans in Oregon, were fired from their jobs as drug counselors because they were ingesting peyote. And the court said that the state law, first of all, that prohibited them from doing that, and that the firing was okay. So, you know, the firing stands.
Right, and so Native American church is not an umbrella protection for peyote use anymore.
Now the state of Alaska may have made some sort of but the state of Alaska may have made some sort of accommodation, which is perfectly fine, perfectly legal. They may have passed a law that said that, you know, if you're a Native American and you're doing this as part of a religious ceremony, it's fine. Again, I don't know.
But okay.
If they did that, that would be perfectly fine, and the courts would enforce that law, you know, just like they'd enforce a law that says you can't smoke it ever, or ingest it in this case, ever.
All right. Thanks, Mary. You'll be up next. Marion Fairbanks, David Mashey of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Church and state is the subject. Mary is our caller from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. Thank you for handling this very appropriate subject.
Thank you.
My concern is, I wonder if a leader that believed in the rapture or the end of times would approach reality different than those with a traditional sense of history and time.
Well, I don't
think... I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
I was going to say, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, people have talked a lot about... I don't mean to compare one country's political system to another, but people have made that made that a concern regarding Iran's president, who I guess believes that it's some sort of end time, some sort of coming end time, and that might make, you know, especially if Iran gets nuclear weapons, that could certainly have an impact on their sorts of decisions. In this country, I mean, again, we have to be careful. We can't say that someone's particular religious tradition makes them, unqualified for office. The Constitution itself. Remember, when we talk about the First Amendment, we're talking about an amendment to the Constitution. And even though the Bill of Rights was approved just a few years after the Constitution was ratified, it's still an amendment. The Constitution itself, the original document, only mentions religion once. And it does in Article 6, and what it says is there shall be no religious test for office, which means it doesn't matter what your religious beliefs are, it doesn't matter what church you belong to, that cannot be a reason to keep you from public office. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, this was also directed, when it was written, it was also directed at people who had no religion, because I think, you know, we have to remember there was, and there still is, quite a bit of hostility to people who do not believe in God.
Mary,
also there to protect them as well.
All right, thank you, Mary. I think there is a group, a Pentecostal group known as Joel's Army, that believes regardless of rapture issues, that it's the responsibility of the people on earth to bring about God's kingdom on earth, and this is a genuine, you know, religious belief area.
Do we know where Sarah Palin stands in that?
Nobody's been really able to totally pin her down on it.
Okay. Yeah, and I know you all know more about your governor than I do, but at least as far as I've read, Sarah Palin no longer attends an Assembly of God or a Pentecostal church. She now goes to, or was going to, I believe it was a Bible church, more traditional sort of evangelical, non-denominational.
Right, yeah, a Bible-believing type of church. Yeah, so Mary, the answer is we don't know.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Eric in Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eric.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to get back to the discussion around the caller that wondered why Sarah Palin was being questioned about her strong religious beliefs when other candidates weren't being questioned, like Obama and whatnot. I think the reason is pretty clear. It has to do with Sarah Palin's public statement that she was proud of her son's going off to...
Eric, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that is one of the most misunderstood public statements ever. It's been taken out of context over and over again. She said, we should pray that they are doing God's will. She did not say it's God's will that we're in Iraq.
Maybe I misunderstood will for war, because what I heard on when I watched it on national TV was that she was proud of her son going to war because in Iraq because it was God's war. But it was probably will, and that was what word that was misunderstood. That could be very well be true. However, I think that's the crux of the reason why she is being questioned now.
Good. Thank you, Eric. Yeah. I think you could be right. The library thing is also a part of it, however. Let's go to the other Eric over here. Joins program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to suggest that President Bush and the Republicans have really given Christianity a black eye. They seem to imply that if Americans don't agree with them, then they're neither Christian nor good Americans.
So you're concerned of a sort of an intolerance that you're seeing build up under fundamentalism? Is that?
Yeah. Most Christians that I am familiar with, we believe our God is a God of love and peace and understanding. And I suggest that if people want to search through the news and look for examples of true Christians, that they look at the Amish in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, rather than the crew in Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, Pennsylvania. Of course, I come from Pennsylvania, and I'm very proud of the religious heritage of that state.
But to be honest, I think the example of Christianity that we're being fed right now is an aberration of what it's truly meant to be.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
It's one of the reasons we have this show, so people can talk things through. Let's go to Julie in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Julie.
Hi, thank you. I want to make a couple of points. First, about the caller who was earlier seeming to be bothered by the fact that many voters are questioning Palin's religious beliefs or any other candidate's religious beliefs. It certainly is a good thing that voters would look at how a candidate thinks, and what better way to assess how somebody thinks than to consider, do they or do they not respect science? Do they or do they not consider a war to be a test that is from God? These are things that voters are entitled to consider. And I was called by a pollster during the primaries when Mitt Romney was still in the race, and the pollster was kind of a push poll, and they were trying to get me to say that, we should never consider somebody's religious thinking. And I resisted that and said, well, of course, I would consider how somebody thinks. What else would I judge a candidate on? How they look? We need to look at how somebody thinks. And I wanted to make the point that, since you mentioned Jefferson earlier, that Jefferson was widely regarded, as your guest mentioned, widely regarded as not being religious enough. And I think that if he were running today, he couldn't get elected, because Jefferson was so pro-science that he had a Bible. He took the Christian Bible, and he removed all of the things in the Christian Bible that he thought were idiotic, and he wound up with a little tiny thing of the good pieces of philosophy that were in the Christian Bible. But he was certainly criticized for having removed the idiotic things from the Bible. But I think your guess would be, you know, I think he would find the fact that George Bush and Sarah Palin have both, you know, expressed, you know, their views on how a war, an invasion or an occupation can stem from our views about it being a mission from God, that that's really an important issue.
Okay, but Julie, I think that's very well articulated. I will have to correct you that she didn't say invading Iraq was a task that is from God. She said we should pray that it is a task that is from God. And I think it's a very important distinction.
I've read the article. I don't have it in front of me. But
well, I'm telling you, most of the quotes don't use that part, and that's unfortunate. Okay?
Well, my original point, though, is that voters are entitled to examine
how
a candidate thinks, because a future vice president or president's thought process is going to affect their actions. And one way to look at how somebody's thought process works is to look at, are they rational or not?
Absolutely.
Respectful of science or not? And if they truly believe, and belief is just another form of thinking, if they think that science is not to be believed, and if they think that the Earth is 6,000 years old, or if they think the end of days is coming, that of necessity affects their worldview and their actions.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I think that third point we would just have to guess about, because nobody can tell the future. David Mosche, it's been really enjoyable having you on the show. We got just a minute to sum up here.
Yeah, I was just going to say your caller was referring to what's been called the Jefferson Bible, where he excised all of the miracles from the New Testament and left, as she said, left the philosophy
A lot of the deists said, well, creation is miracle enough. We don't need this other stuff.
Well, I'm not 100%. I'm not an expert on Jefferson. I don't know exactly what his beliefs were, but I do know a little about that. Again, that Bible that your guest talked a little bit about. And I was just going to also say that, candidates are certainly asked about things that have to do with religion, and they're criticized. President Bush was certainly criticized, whether rightly or wrongly, you know, for turning the war on terror into a religious war. Again, I'm not saying that he did. I'm just saying that that was certainly a criticism lodged against him. Obviously Governor Palin and Barack Obama and John McCain. I've heard people say John McCain, you know, doesn't know whether he's a Baptist or an Episcopalian. So candidates have been, they're criticized pretty routinely.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Talk of Alaska, back next week.
Possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 25 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8400. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.